Medical Mission of Mercy. Roger Lyon, Graciela Sarmiento, James Thornton, and Andrew Teal were compassionate fellow citizens who gave to others in need. Our community has lost four generous friends. I'd like to start out with approval of the minutes. All the minutes were sent out to the commissioners, and I'd like to, any changes? Yes, Commissioner Arnold. Second? Okay. All those in favor of approval, say aye.
Aye.
Okay, great. Now is the time for public comment, and that's for persons desiring to speak on issues other than those scheduled items on the agenda that are within the scope of the interest of the Health Commission. So public comment, anyone who would like to come up and speak?
Good evening, Dr. Borenstein and Health Commissioners. My name is Linda. I have a Bachelor of Science and tutored cell biology 35 years ago. I come to you with an urgent matter affecting public health that most are not aware of, smart meters. Smart meters are part of a wireless network that PG&E is installing on homes and businesses with transmitter receivers on telephone poles, street lights, etc., all over the community. I began studying the biological effects of wireless 5 years ago when my children wanted cell phones. A few weeks ago, PG&E sent me a letter about installing a smart meter at my house. I went to emfsafetynetwork.org to learn more. I found a huge public outcry. Many people were getting sick, heart palpitations, dizziness, insomnia, headaches, hearing problems, flu-like symptoms, worsening of existing problems, etc. Hawaii and 18 California communities, including San Francisco County and City, don't want them and have moratoriums or laws banning them. Watsonville drew up an emergency ordinance banning them as they present, quote, a current and immediate threat to public health, safety, and welfare, unquote. Smart meters emit huge pulses of microwaves. The bioeffects of microwave radiation include DNA damage, therefore increased risk of cancers, cellular stress, cognitive difficulties, brainwave alteration, heart rhythm disturbances, red blood cell clumping, and environmental impacts affecting anything living, especially pine trees, birds, bees, and amphibians, etc. Even if smart meters were to emit intensities at a fraction of the FCC standard, which is 1,000 microwatts per centimeter squared, like they say they do, there's a host of studies detailing the complaints our residents have experienced. Here's plenty of evidence. You have this, and it's got two pages of evidence of harm, well below FCC standards. German doctors filed the Freiberger appeal, that is this document here, in October 2002, detailing their observations of dramatic rises in severe and chronic diseases that got better when microwave radiation was reduced. Children, the elderly, pregnant women, and the sick are especially at risk. The Soviets found overexposed radiation workers permanently disabled. Smart meters have already caused a lot of health problems. PG&E told me I cannot opt out. What will it take to get this stopped in our county until we can investigate further? Petitions and ordinance proposal? Please carefully consider this potential threat to public health. Thank you for listening. And your question, Dr. I don't know how to see your name, I'm sorry. I happen to have the chart. Cell phones emit 30 to 10,000 microwatts per centimeter squared, whereas the most conservative countries such as, or cities such as Salzburg, they're at about one. They require no more than about one microwatt per centimeter squared. So you can see that it's quite a difference.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? I'd like to, next thing on the agenda is an overview of Operation Medicine Cabinet in San Luis Obispo County. And with us today is Chief Tim Olivas. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, and thank you to the Commission for this offer to get this word out there of how this came about and the availability to the public that we have now. A brief history on how it first occurred. Well, as you know, with the prescription medications or over-the-counter medications, especially Schedule I narcotics, once they go out of a pharmacy, there's really no way available for them to get out of the household if they become expired or they're no longer needed. So that was kind of the birthplace for Operation Medicine Cabinet, is the need to get those out of the households. Because currently they were either being flushed down the toilet or placed in the waste and go into our landfills, which creates environmental issues because the wastewater treatment plants are not designed. They're designed for human waste, not for the medications. Going to the landfills, they seep into our groundwater system. And for law enforcement, it created issues. It is the number one abused substance by teenagers today, is prescription medications. So getting these off of the street safely in a manner where they could be disposed of properly was of critical importance. So this originally started out with a wastewater treatment plant in Morro Bay approaching Integrated Waste Management Authority and discussing this problem. They saw the need, but there had to be a law enforcement component in order to make this work, because the drugs had to come off of the street through law enforcement to make it legal so they could be properly disposed of. That's how this was all born back in June, a collaborative meeting between County Integrated Waste Management Authority and law enforcement. It was brought to all the law enforcement professionals, and all seven municipalities and the Sheriff's Department with Pat Hedges embraced this program, saw the value in it, saw the need in it. Everybody stepped up to the plate. Integrated Waste Management Authority provided the drop boxes. They purchased them. They had them painted. They had them installed at each law enforcement agency. They made a pamphlet, which I provided for you here today, which talks about the program. So it was a real neat collaborative effort, and I never would have thought in June that we would have been kicking this program off in September. But timing is everything. And we found out at that same time when we were doing this that the Drug Enforcement Administration was also pushing a one-day take-back program at the federal level. So we joined with them and used our drop boxes in the county for their one-day take-back program. This was a four-hour period on September 25th. We took in 200 pounds of medications within this county that we took off the street, and they are disposed of through an incineration process. So it was truly an amazing kickoff to the program. And the beauty of the program is now that it continues on here in our county. Each law enforcement agency and a municipality, all of your city police departments have a drop box either outside their facility or inside the lobby available to the public to drop off household medications, whether they're prescription or over the counter. The Sheriff's Department at all three of their substations in Templeton, in Los Osos, and Oceano also have a drop box available. So we have 10 drop boxes available for people to properly dispose of their medications. So I'm your spokesman here today, but it was several agencies working together in really a very short time frame, from the federal all the way down to the city municipal agencies and the county and state, working together to make this such a successful program. So I'd be happy to entertain any questions if you have.
How are you talking this up? How are you broadcasting it out to all the people who can actually get it in consumers' hands?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one of the reasons I appreciate this opportunity to get the education out there. It came on so quickly. We actually did press releases, and we had a news conference for the one-day kickoff coupled with the continuation program of Operation Medicine Cabinet. Integrated Waste Management Authority had the pamphlets made up. Those are available at the police departments. We're getting them out to the pharmacies so people could pick them up and learn about the program. Word of mouth is a big portion of our communication, and hopefully through boards like this and the commission that we could get that word out there and show the availability.
Great. Is this a pamphlet available as a PDF anywhere on a website?
Yes. The majority of the police departments have added that to their website.
Okay.
I know it's on ours. I know Paso Robles has added it, and so if they go to their municipality police department, it is typically on there. I believe the Sheriff's Department has it added to theirs also.
Great. Yes.
I have a question regarding how you best dispose of it. Would you put your bottles in the disposal with your name, your phone number, and all that stuff? Would you take all the pill out of the bottle and put it into a baggie or something?
Great question. Thank you for asking that. We ask that it be maintained in the original packaging. It's easier for us to handle it. We do ask that you remove your personal information. So if you bring it in the bottle, just take the label off, dispose of the label, and put the bottle and everything, or if it's in cardboard packaging, put that all in the drop box with your personal information removed.
Yes. I think I heard you say it was incinerated. I'm wondering where it does get incinerated and is the, you know, how much potential pollution is coming out of this incineration process.
Thank you. There is two incineration plants in California that we have access to here on the Central Coast. One is the Covanta plant over off Interstate 5, and the other one is Long Beach. It's the SURF plant is what it's called. Those are the only two incineration plants that are certified to go through this process of the incineration. I couldn't give you the details as far as the pollution aspects of it, but I just tell you that there is some cost involved in this program for the municipalities as well as the county, because we have to transport it, first take it out and enter it into our process so it is legally disposed of, and then transport it to these facilities where the Covanta plant is still currently charging a fee for the incineration, where the Long Beach facility does it as a no cost because of the benefit of the program to society and the environment.
Any further questions? Yes, Mr. Warren.
From the drop box?
Right.
Yes, that's why they're at law enforcement facilities. It becomes the responsibility of that law enforcement agency. So they have property evidence technicians that deal with all the other evidence and property and narcotics. It is kept separate. It is considered to be a non-evidence item. So, but it is still brought into the facility. What is called a CAT event through our record management system is entered. It is weighed, and then it is processed through a chain of custody, just like normal evidence, until it is destroyed down at the facility of one of the two facilities that we utilize.
Process similar to what Santa Barbara County is doing. Brought the first flyer to us, model that was in Santa Barbara County.
We've been talking about this for a couple of years. And I just want to acknowledge that you guys have really taken this to task and done a terrific job with it. Anyway, that was the question on that.
Yes, it's a great follow-up. I'm going to give credit where credit is due. I think part of the process of getting this operational in 4 months is we're not afraid of, we don't feel the need to reinvent the wheel. Mm-hmm. This program was readily available and operating in Santa Barbara, so we contacted the county. It's mainly just the county sheriff's department down there that runs it. So we contacted them to learn how they have been doing it and how successful it is. It was a little bit daunting at first because when they started describing how much medication was coming in, it made us kind of take a step back a little bit. But it's just too valuable of a program, and everybody involved recognized that we'll find a way to make it happen and move it forward.
I wonder if there's any statistics anywhere being kept that we might be able to see if there's any drop in the number of overdoses and that kind of thing that's happening maybe over a year or a couple of years. Is there any research being done on that you know
of? Not to my knowledge. There's nobody tasked with that specifically. We might be able to generalize along those lines. I could tell you just at the Morro Bay Police Department, we're averaging about 10 to 15 pounds a week of medications that are being removed from the households, which is a significant number. So I think even indirectly, we may not have some hard statistics, but just getting that medication, not only for our societal benefits and abuse issues, but for the environmental impacts are going to be huge.
And would people from, say, Cambria be able to bring their medications to the Morro Bay Police Department?
Absolutely. It's one reason that this program really took off, too, is that all the agencies embraced it, which means there's 10 drop-off points. So it's kind of spread throughout the county, and not one agency is taking the brunt of the financial as well as the personal time involved with managing this program. So, yeah, they're encouraged to use whatever facility is closest to them. That's from Paso Robles, Atascadero. All your municipalities have a Dropbox in their facility, as well as, as I mentioned, the Templeton substation with the Sheriff's Department, Oceano, and Los Osos.
And have you contacted, like, the community health centers, doctor's offices, hospice, to get your flyers in with them and let them know?
The Integrated Waste Management Authority has really taken the lead on that, getting that information out there, because they also, there's no sharps involved in this, no needles. It's prescription medication only. And they also have the needle take-back program through the pharmacies. So they are really involved in getting that education out to partners who could educate the community about these drop-off boxes. You're welcome.
Any further questions?
Yes.
Home in North Carolina was involved in a program to get those kind of bottles to third world countries for medications or something. Do you have any further use for those bottles?
We don't at this time. The labor involved with, that's why we asked that it just be disposed of in the bottle. We don't go through the medications or the bottles.
Oh, okay, you said it all.
Everything is incinerated, all is one.
Okay.
We have been working with a local pharmacy, and they were working on a similar take-back program for, like, non-scheduled one for, like, high blood pressure medication and stuff that may be turned in that's really not related into prohibited to have. Mm-hmm. And they were working in third world countries where that medication could be taken out of Operation Medicine Cabinet and utilized to go to the third world countries. We're still in the process of looking at that as an option.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any further questions?
No, I wasn't on anything.
Yes.
Since it's an ongoing project now, is there any plan in the works to do like an annual day, like the kickoff day, where we really remind people to clean out their cabinets and that, or is it just strictly ongoing now?
It's a great question. I don't want to speak on behalf of the federal government, but that was their first ever annual take-back program, and they recognize the need for it. My understanding is their goal is every 6 to 12 months they're looking at of doing that one-day take-back program again. So we're hoping that, you know, it's. I'm sure there's funding issues and things like that, so I don't want to speak on behalf of them, but that is part of their goal, too, is to do a big one-day take-back program through the DEA to hopefully keep people aware and educate people that it's out there.
There is another day coming up, and I believe it's November 16th, which is an Operation Medicine Chest, and I think that might be sponsored by a medical association or something. I can email you some information on that, or who should maybe I let know.
That would be fine. I'd be happy to be the point for that and get it to the right people and help coordinate with them.
Because I think there's going to be, again, a lot of national attention for that, too. So it gives you an opportunity, again, to get it out in the public.
Yes, we'd be more than willing to look at that. Great idea.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is a big deal for us. We've been working on this for years. So.
Outstanding.
This is wonderful. Thank you for coming by.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to assemble a panel to discuss Domestic Violence Awareness Month. How should we... I'm going to sit here. Okay. So you could come on up and sit. Thank you all for coming. Should we go ahead and start with Diana, or okay, good, thank you.
Hi,
Can you hear me? I'll start over. Again, my name is Belinda Benassi. I am a Child Welfare Services Program Manager with the Department of Social Services. Part of my job is collaborating with local community partners and the state on child abuse prevention efforts. And tonight I was asked to come speak to you about the co-occurrence of domestic violence and child abuse. So I will start off by just briefly outlining what I'll be talking about, which is children's exposure to domestic violence. I will be providing some information on Child Welfare Services referral data. I will talk about our local community domestic violence protocols and speak about some of the resources that we have available and Child Welfare Services ongoing events. The three primary categories of children's exposure to domestic violence are hearing or seeing the event. A lot of times the perpetrators or the victims will say, oh, our children are not exposed to it because they're not in the room. However, recent studies have found that if a child is asked, a child who lives in a home that domestic violence occurs, if they're asked about details about the event, they will be able to provide information about the event. So even though they're not in the room, they are hearing what is occurring. Another example of how they're exposed to abuse is a physical injury. This tends to happen with the younger children. Sometimes the child is being held by the victim as the abuse is occurring, or the young child is hanging on to the mother or the father as the abuse is occurring as well. And another method could be where objects are being thrown and the children are in the middle of it and they get hit somehow, and that's where the physical abuse could occur. Another is the aftermath of the effect. The children have to hold that responsibility of keeping the family secret of the domestic violence that is happening in the home, and also the stresses of living in a home where they don't know day in or day out when the next event is going to occur. So that is a lot of stressors that are added to the child. The potential effects of the children, and I'm going to read these because I want to make sure that I get them right. For example, for infants, may have difficulty developing attachments to the caregiver. Preschool may regress developmentally or suffer from eating or sleep disturbances. School age may struggle with peer relationships, academic performance, or emotional stability. And adolescents are at a higher risk for either perpetrating or becoming victims of teen dating violence. When a referral comes into Child Welfare Services, the intake social worker screens the referral, and based on the screening, there's three outcomes for the referral. The first one would be that it will be evaluated out, no further action will be taken, and that means that it doesn't meet the definition of abuse or neglect. The second is that it will be evaluated out, but San Luis Obispo County is a differential response county in that we have an alternative response where we can refer to our community partner, which is CAPSLO, to provide prevention services. And a lot of these prevention services, well, the most important one specifically is parenting education. And CAPSLO also offers a program for parenting, and I believe it might be for couples. And this is for positive opportunities for parenting. POPs, might get that wrong. But so that allows us to offer that services where before, I would say maybe 5 or 10 years ago, we couldn't offer that service. So that's a service that we're able to provide to hopefully, if there's just small little signs, an agency can intervene. So hopefully that the prevention will be effective and the child will not see that violence or be abused. And then thirdly, they will be screened in for a Child Welfare Services response. The most common allegations for these referrals, they normally fall into either general abuse, general neglect, physical abuse, or emotional abuse. I did provide a handout of contributing factors, and I'll go over that a little bit for you. Based on the special project codes that our social workers enter into the case management system, we're able to identify whether some of the families that are being referred, what are their indicators or what are the risk factors. And I want to point out that Domestic violence is the second most common contributing factor next to substance abuse. We collect year-to-date data, and this is the handout. And in this handout, it states that out of 815 referrals, 323, which is approximately 37%, include domestic violence as a contributing factor or risk indicator. I went a little bit further and looked into one of the allegations, which is emotional abuse. And for the month of September, we had 53 referrals that fell in the category of allegation of emotional abuse. And I want to stress allegation because that's all it is. These are just allegations. They have not been substantiated or anything like that. But out of the 53 referrals, 42, which is about 80%, involve domestic violence. So that's a really high number for emotional abuse. Then I want to move on to state that we do have, in this community, in San Luis Obispo, we have local domestic violence protocols. And these are protocols between the Department of Social Services, law enforcement, and community partners. And the purposes of these protocols are if a family comes into one of our agencies that we've agreed to collaborate and provide services for this family so that they're not being pulled by different agencies at the same time. We can all collaborate, find out what the needs are for the family, ensure that the victim is safe and the children are safe, and work together as a team in the community to provide whatever services are needed. And the goals for these protocols are to protect the child, to help the abused parent protect herself or himself, and the child or children using supportive and empowering interventions, to hold the abuser accountable for her or his actions and responsible for stopping the abusive behavior. This also supports, like I mentioned before, how it's a protocol that supports our efforts to collaborate, but also put our resources together. With all the budget cuts, a lot of agencies have been basically restrained on what services are offered out there. So that's why collaboration is really important, because if one agency is not able to provide the services, for example, for Department of Social Services, we can offer CalWORKs, Food Stamps, Medi-Cal services, but they have to be eligible for that service. Where other agencies, if they come into our agency and we can't provide those services, we work very closely with other community partners and say, we can't assist this family, what can you do? So as an agency, as a member of the agency, I clearly see it, and I'm very grateful for our community partners that they're always willing to step in, and it's just always, members are just a phone call away. So some of the community resources and services that are needed, especially for these families that are experiencing domestic violence, are, as I listed before, CalWORKs, Food Stamps, or Medi-Cal, daycare, temporary housing, shelter, legal services, counseling, transportation, and the counseling effort was mentioned, it's for substance abuse or mental health, transportation, clothing, parenting, education, emergency protective orders, or restraining orders. These are some of the most common services that are required. And I just want to conclude by mentioning child welfare services, some of the ongoing efforts that we're working on. We meet quarterly. We have an interagency meeting where we meet every quarter, and these are agencies that, for example, the shelters, mental health, housing, Department of Social Services, and other, I'm probably excluding a lot of them, and I apologize, but It's an agency committee meeting where we meet together on a quarterly basis to exchange information as to where the agency is at due to budget cuts, what are they being able to afford on provider services. If they have a program that's coming up or something, this is the forum that the information is exchanged. And tomorrow, actually, we're having our next interagency meeting, and being that it's Domestic Violence Awareness Month, our speaker will be Jenny Adams from North County Women's Shelter, and she'll be talking to our community partners about domestic violence at this meeting as well. We're also collaborating with community partners in hosting our first poverty conference in San Luis Obispo County. A lot of the domestic violence incidents are due to economic stressors, so we're collaborating with several members of local agencies and nonprofits profits in hosting a poverty opportunity conference in February 2011. We are also, Child Welfare Services, we're in the middle of our Child and Family Services review, so next year in February or March 2011, we will be hosting community forums where the community has an opportunity to attend these forums and let us know how are we doing, what we need to focus on for the next 3 years. We'll be using that information, collecting that information to write up our next system improvement plan. And also, finally, we're collaborating with community partners on a domestic violence task force to host the 2011 Domestic Violence Conference here in San Luis Obispo. So we're working hard. Thank you very much.
Can you hear me? Great. Hi, I'm Sarah, Sarah O. I work at the Women's Shelter Program in San Luis Obispo, and I work primarily in prevention, looking at primary prevention on the Cal Poly campus, as well as in the rest of the community of San Luis Obispo. So I'm here to talk a little bit about domestic violence, how we define it, how we see it play out at the Women's Shelter Program, a little bit about the services that we offer there. I'm sorry for those of you who have to look at my back. So the way that we define it is that domestic violence, and now the vocabulary is changing, actually. We now call it intimate partner violence, more so in the field to be more inclusive of abuse within same-sex relationships or people who may be living together but not married or dating relationships as well. So intimate partner violence is defined as a pattern of coercive behavior used to control partners by the threat or the use of physical assault. So intimate partner violence doesn't always need to be an incident of violence. But as long as that threat is there and as long as that intimidation or fear factor is there used to control another partner, that is where we see intimate partner violence happening within a relationship. It can happen between, of course, married partners, heterosexual couples. It also happens in dating relationships, people who are cohabitating, and also in same-sex relationships as well. We have served all of people from kind of all across the board, different socioeconomic levels, different ethnicities, and all of that. So we kind of see it as a crime that's kind of undiscriminating. We see it affect all different levels and all different kinds of people. Some different types of abuse that we see. And when I go through different types of abuse, it's important to note that none of these types exist independently of each other, but they do work together and are used kind of in a matrix to keep a victim of violence down. And so, of course, the first type of abuse that people normally think of is the stereotypical black guy, is the physical violence, and that's something that we see quite a bit. Bruises in different stages of healing in different parts of the body is a big indicator of physical violence and abuse. We also have verbal abuse, which Belinda hit upon briefly. Verbal abuse sounds a lot like you're stupid, you're ugly, you're fat, and nobody's going to want you if you ever leave me. And again, those things are usually used to break down a victim's self-esteem so that the batterer or the abuser can exert more control and power over this victim. And emotional abuse is something that underlies all the different other types of abuse. If my boyfriend or girlfriend punches me in the face, that is going to have some significant emotional ramifications. And it's interesting to hear a lot of our clients say that you can heal from the physical wounds, but the things that are the most difficult to heal from actually are the things that they have said to them. So the emotional abuse is a huge barrier to leaving an abusive relationship, as are all of these. Psychological abuse is another type. Before I worked at the Women's Shelter Program, I worked at Hancock College, and I worked with a lot of students there. And unfortunately, this is something that I witnessed there with parents who were abusive or abuse going on in the household between the two parents. And one of my students had all her doors taken down in her house. And that's actually something we've seen quite a few times since I've been working at the Women's Shelter. The removal of doors basically symbolizes or kind of communicates to the victims within the household that no matter where they go, no matter what time of day it is, even if they're going to the bathroom, even if they're sleeping in their bed, they're never safe from this abuser, and that abuser can always find them. The student I saw this happen to, we were at a camp in Catalina Island, and she was still in fear there, even though we were nowhere near Santa Maria. But that's the kind of psychological toll that those actions can take on somebody who's being abused psychologically. Economic abuse is something that we also see, and this could look like a lot of different things. It could look like somebody who makes a good amount of money being abused because that person has no access to their resources. We've had cases where someone was working at a bank, and she actually made a good amount of money, but at the end of the day, she'd come home to her husband, and she'd have to turn over her wallet and all of her paychecks and everything, and he had sole control over all the resources, even though she was making the money. So that's a kind of economic abuse. We've had also a case where one of our clients decided to leave her husband, and he actually worked with credit reports, and he actually messed with her credit, and so she was unable to get loans, and it was this big mess, but that's another kind of economic abuse that we see. And of course, economic abuse also plays out if the victim does not work and the abuser does work and uses money as a way to keep the victim from leaving that person. And another way, sexual abuse, marital rape still happens, and we see that too. And a lot of times marital rape is happening within abusive relationships, and also rape within dating relationships as well. Spiritual abuse is something we've become more aware of in the past few years at the Women's Shelter Program. And that could look like a few things. It could look like ridiculing somebody for their spiritual beliefs, you know, saying things like, you must be really stupid if you're going to believe something like that, if you're going to believe in that faith background. And also it could look like using spiritual theology or spiritual dogma or sacred text to justify some kind of abuse. I come from a Buddhist background, and my aunt is in an abusive relationship, physically and otherwise, and she believes that she is in this relationship because she must have harmed her husband in a past life. And I don't know if she came up with that herself or if her husband told her that, but that is kind of how she spiritually justifies the abuse, when my understanding of Buddhism is not that way. So we do see things like that. We have a lot of Latina clients who believe, who come from a Catholic background, who believe that if they get a divorce, they must be going to hell. And so we're seeing a lot of spiritual barriers to leaving for our victims. So we're working with different faith leaders within the community to try to know how to respond well and appropriately and respect where someone's coming from, but also encourage them to be safe within their personal relationships. So those are a few things that we're seeing, and how we are combating them with our services. All of you have a services sheet on your desk, and please let me know if you don't have one or if you need any more. One thing that I would like to report on with our services is that you'll notice there's kind of a gap. We have recently lost our legal grant. We used to be able to, we had a full-time lawyer on staff who could aid in custody issues, property issues, and other things where there's domestic violence or stalking or sexual assault present. But unfortunately, we cannot do that anymore. We also do not have a temporary restraining order clinic anymore either. So we are now referring to the family law facilitator in court, as well as a paralegal who does things on a sliding scale out in Los Osos. North County Women's Shelter still has a temporary restraining order clinic as well, so that's where we're referring those to. But in terms of what we do have, we obviously have a 24-hour crisis line and a safe house. And that number is right there under shelter program, 781-6400. And that is open 24 hours. And it's always, there always is someone who's a state-mandated crisis counselor on the line. And whoever needs safety at the moment, whether that be a woman or a man or children, the time can be eligible to go into our safe house, or we'll find safety for them in some other way. If it is a male caller, we can get them to a confidential site at a hotel or a motel, and we can do things that way. So we offer safety. We also offer safety planning so that someone can, usually a victim will know when an episode of violence is coming. They can feel it building, and so we safety plan with them and go through where could they go, where could they drop off the kids, how to avoid the actual incident of abuse happening if they're not yet ready to leave the relationship. Safety planning. We also provide children's services, transports, and childcare for those who are in our safe house. We do offer some legal services still. We're hoping that we'll be able to offer restraining order. We're trying to train our own staff who are not paralegals and things like that on how to help out with restraining orders. So, and you can always call and we can refer you to the correct people. Case management, these are people that have basically connections with all the other nonprofits and all the other social service providers in the county, and they can help. They can help our clients get food, clothing, financial help if they need to pay rent or utilities if they're on their own and are still struggling financially. And also, our safe house is handicap accessible as well, for obvious reasons. And right now we have 6 rooms, and each room can hold up to 4 people, whether that be young children or women. We also offer counseling, and that is our Center for Alternatives to Domestic Violence, and our counseling number is right there. We will never turn someone away for their inability to pay. So it's a sliding scale fee, and there are individual group counseling. We also have LGBTQAI-friendly counseling as well, where we have LGBTQ staff who do that, therapists who do that. We are a dual agency. We also counsel and have therapy for children. If they are between the ages of 3 to 17, it's completely free, and it doesn't have to be domestic violence in that case. Any kind of child abuse, we can provide therapy for. We also have self-referred batterers counseling as well, but they have to be self-referred. We do not do state-mandated. And we also have therapists in high schools and junior highs in the county as well. We have a transitional housing service, and we recently, good news, just got 4 more units down in Grover Beach. So we have 6 units in San Luis Obispo and 4 units in Grover Beach, and so 10 units in all of transitional housing. And these are for people who have left an abusive relationship and are now trying to be on their own. And so this way they can kind of be under our wing in the sense that they still have access to all of our services, and we offer a government-subsidized rent. So that way it's a lot easier on them financially. But they are learning to get back on their feet and be self-sufficient. So they still have to learn how to call the utilities and turn their water on and pay all their bills on time and get their rent in on time and work and all of those things. But at the same time, they still have access to our employment assistance where we can help them write their resume, get clothing for interviews, how to interview, how to even look online for a job, and some very basic things and some not so basic things on how to be self-sufficient. We also have case management, and I talked a little bit about that earlier, but they also do a lot of advocacy and transports for children if they need to be transported from school to their counseling site or whatnot. And again, they do safety planning, and they do a lot of workshops, even on things like how to eat healthily and how to cook well for your kids, because a lot of times abuse is intergenerational, so they may not have developed those skills from their parents, and a big financial burden is not being able to use their money well. And so they spend money on things like eating out when really they could be saving a lot of money if they were able to cook for their kids, but because they never saw their parents do that, they lack those skills themselves. So a lot of different kinds of workshops. And we also do community education. And like I work out of Cal Poly with SAFER and women's programs on looking at how to cultivate atmospheres and environments of healthy relationships to prevent violence from ever happening within dating relationships at Cal Poly. We also do the mandated 40-hour training for all our volunteers, and we are at a lot of different events and have a lot of different presentations if you ever are interested in that. So, yeah, that's about it.
Sorry. Okay, now you can hear me. Sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. So I work for the district attorney's office, and we have 59 centers, victim centers in the state. Most of them are are housed in the district attorney's office. Some of them are in probation departments, and there's one in the state that is actually a nonprofit. So we have basically a victim center in every county. In San Luis County, we've got 17 employees, and then plus we have Cal Poly interns. Basically, what we do is we work to reduce the trauma, frustration, inconvenience experienced by victims, witnesses, and family members affected by crime. We basically walk them through the criminal justice process. When someone is a victim, they look at the criminal justice process and they go, oh my gosh, what do I do now? And they just are so confused. So we walk them through that process. Victim witness started in about 1970s. November 4th of 2008, the state of California approved Proposition 9. If you look at the little orange pamphlet that I gave you, this measure amended the California Constitution to provide additional rights to victims. So we give this to every victim that comes through our office, and it talks about what their rights are as a victim. Basically, it's to be informed about the criminal justice process, about their rights to speak and be heard at sentencing, dispositions, at bail hearings, court orientation. We basically go through the court process, explain what's going to happen at each proceeding. Then we also inform them about their civil remedies and financial assistance that are available. So that's just the pamphlet that talks about victims' rights. Services, crisis intervention. We have, when a police officer goes out to a crime scene on a domestic violence case, they hand these little blue cards out, which you have. And so what will happen is maybe the police were out there last night. Well, the next day we get a call from this victim because they're in crisis. They have been taken out of their home, or they have no, like Sarah had talked about, no access to the checkbook, no access to money. So that leads me to the emergency assistance. We have a fund in our office that we can get them $200 worth of food vouchers, or maybe a tank of gas, or maybe put them up in a motel for a night, just get them out of that crisis and help them through the crisis situation. We also we refer them to a lot of agencies. Our partners, community partners, we do a lot of work with the Department of Social Services as well as the Women's Shelter. So we do a lot of referral with victims. We do direct counseling. We have a lot of people that will come in and maybe something didn't go right in court and they're upset and they're in crisis when they're in our office. Angela's going to talk about the Victims of Crime Compensation Program a little bit later. We help victims get property returned, because whenever a police officer is out there, they will take property, and then that victim's going, well, wait a minute, I need my laptop to go look for a job, or I need this. So we try to help them get that property back. We also, I think that probably the biggest thing is working with them, the orientation just to the criminal justice process. Felony and misdemeanor, very different going through the process, so we help them through that process. We go to court with them. We will, if it's a minor, we'll sit with them on the stand. I sat with a 5-year-old last year on the stand, and I'm going to tell you, you have to go with that child, and you take them up and let them sit in the chair and tell you, what school they go to, and just kind of get them used to that. And that's what we do. We walk them through that. We keep them updated on what's going on the court case. Where are we at in the process? We also help them with restitution. A lot of victims, any kind of out-of-pocket expenses, restitution, could be even, the door was broken, they lost wages, and so we try to help them mileage to and from doctor appointments. We try to help them get that restitution information to the judge so that they can get that ordered from that perpetrator. We also help on homicides and manslaughter with funeral arrangements with the victim's family. We usually will go to the actual funeral home and help them, go through that process, which is very stressful. Witness notification, we do when you get subpoenas in the mail. We basically walk them through that as well. And we work on we refer them for temporary restraining orders. The advocates, we deal mostly with, we deal with all crime against person, assaults, child abuse, DUI with injury, homicide, manslaughters, kidnapping, robbery, sexual assaults, hit and runs, and domestic violence. Our domestic violence, our domestic violence victims require a larger amount of our time, I think, than the other crimes. they just need more help, you know, maybe financial, housing, and you have a domestic violence pamphlet that I put up there. I don't have one, but I gave it to you up there. Every domestic violence case that comes through the district attorney's office, we type up a criminal protective order. And this order is good for up to 3 years while that the perpetrator is on probation. And it's to protect the children. There's two types. There's one that is it's like a peaceful contact. If we have a lot of domestic violence victims who recant and it didn't happen, and so they want maybe to still live with that perpetrator. So we will do a peaceful contact order. We type those up at the first arraignment, at the first court case, our court date. We also do a no contact order where the perpetrator has to stay 50 yards away from the person, the victim, and 100 yards away from the residence. Those are done on every case that we do. We also support the victim during interviews with the district attorney. We have 3 felony prosecutors in our office, and they prosecute child abuse and felony child abuse and felony domestic violence. And they interview every victim on those cases, and we are the support person with that DA. We're the liaison between the DA and that victim. We also support them. We have what they call CATE interviews. It's a child abuse interview, and we are the support person of the family. So that's what we do with those. We are there with the family, again, explaining the processes. A lot of victims feel that they're the ones that press the charges in domestic violence cases. They do not press charges. We do want to hear what they, you know, what they would like to see happen, but it's the district attorney that decides whether or not there's enough evidence to press charges against somebody for domestic violence. But we do relay the information from the victim to the district attorney who's handling that case. Also, this criminal protective orders, they supersede any family orders. So they are the ones, so any family orders are basically not good until this criminal protective order is either terminated or no longer in effect. And these orders are basically to keep the family safe, the children and the victim safe. We coordinate with a lot of agencies, SARP, Sexual Assault Recovery and Prevention Center, Department of Social Services, the Child Welfare Services, North County Shelter, and also the San Luis Obispo County Shelter. We also have juvenile crime. I actually am the juvenile crime advocate in our office, so I deal with all juvenile crime in the county. I work really closely with the truancy officers, the school administrators, and probation. And we see domestic violence with our juveniles just as much, I mean, quite a bit as well as the adult offenders. We also do witness coordination. So if you get a subpoena in the mail, that comes from our office. We handle about 700 to 1,000 subpoenas in a month, about 10,000 a year. That's subpoenas that go out through our office. We do the check-in. We do witness confirmation. We do cancellations of witnesses, and we do cancel a lot of witnesses because only about 5% of our cases go to trial, the jury trials. We send out a lot of subpoenas, but we also cancel a lot of subpoenas. And we do go to court with the victims. We, like I said, with child victims, we can sit up on the stand. We also can with the adult as well. And again, we do any kind of travel, accommodation arrangements for anybody out of town that we need to bring back for a trial. We also arrange for interpreter services. We have 3 interns right now. They handle all our property crimes, the burglaries, auto thefts, and they are juniors and seniors at Cal Poly. And then the last thing is, if any of our victims are sent to prison, we help connect that victim to the California Department of Rehabilitation, Corrections and Rehabilitation, and we notify, they notify the victim of any type of a release of a defendant, the death, escape, transfer, and parole hearings. And if we have a victim that is, let's say, the guy's coming up for parole, they'll actually call us, and we can go to the parole hearing with that victim. So we do see them through the whole process. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Angela Viles, who will talk about elder and dependent adult abuse.
Let's make sure. Is this working? Does
it sound like it? All right. As Diana mentioned, I have to say, though, it's cold in here. I'm Angela Viles, and I am also a victim witness advocate. The difference in Diana and myself is that I work with elders and dependent adults. We have an outreach and advocacy program in our office. Basically, what that means is that I work with elders. An elder is anyone over the age of 65, and I don't mean to upset anyone in the group by calling them an elder, because I have quite a few of my clients that come in and tell me, I'm what? And a dependent adult is anyone between the age of 18 and 64. And it's also a group that any one of us can join at any time. We could walk out that door, be hit by a car, and we're now dependent on others for care. And that's a pretty scary thought, but it puts it into perspective as far as who we're dealing with. Some of you may look at me and think, why is she here? Elders and dependent adults don't have these type of issues, but the reality is they are in domestic violence relationships. They are in those type of situations. So we do need to take special care. To be honest, San Luis Obispo is commonly thought of as a college town, but we're also a retirement community. The majority of California has a 11% population of seniors, and San Luis Obispo is a little under 15%. So we may actually have an increased number of domestic violence incidents involving our elders or dependent adults here. I'd also like to mention that I know Sarah said the new, keyword is intimate partner violence. But I like to look at it as family violence, because a large number of my clientele are not husbands, wives, boyfriends, girlfriends, same sex. It's family member violence. It's grandchildren, it's nieces, it's nephews, it's children. They're living in domestic situations. They may be living in the home, and they may be in that type of relationship, but it's not necessarily intimate partner. But then I also mentioned my children. That's probably one of the most intimate relationships I've ever had in my life, or, will ever have. I pray that I'm never in a criminal situation with either one of them, but it does happen. Unfortunately, I've been involved in the last 2 years in two homicide cases, intimate partner violence, family violence. One of them you may be familiar with, which is the Levine case, which Dorothy Autry was murdered by her grandson. And it's very difficult. And I work on a daily basis with family members that are in, not that drastic of a situation, but they are in an intimate relationship with a family member that's abusing them. And that's why we felt that it was important that we are here today. I'd like to talk about some of the services that we provide. Diana, I'm going to try not to have too much duplication, because she already shared a lot of that. But a difference in our job is that sometimes I have a little more hands-on. I do quite a few more home visits, where I will actually go out to the person's home, whether they're a dependent adult, they have trouble transporting or coming into the courthouse, or they're an elder and maybe driving is no longer, possible for them. So we'll drive out there. I do court escort, where I will actually take our little county car and I'll head out to Shandon or head out to Morro Bay, wherever we're picking them up, and bring them in for the court process. And we do the court orientation. We help with the criminal protective orders. We help with the restitution, which is very important to a lot of these people, because unfortunately, well, fortunately for them, but our elders hold most of the assets, and that's why they have a lot of the family members that do come after them and look, hey, Grandma's got this. She doesn't need it. It's going to be mine someday. I might as well take it now. And through intimidation or fear or one of these other sources, they get into these types of situations. We deal with a lot of crime prevention information, and it may be a little repetitive because I'm dealing with elders that may have some, you know, some dementia or some memory issues, or it's just very, very scary. I can tell you the first time that I had to walk into family law court, I was scared to death. I can't imagine being forced into criminal law, you know, for a situation with someone that I love or that I thought loved me. It's hard. So we do a lot of hand-holding in our job, and some people don't like that term, but that's the reality. That's what we're there for. We also work very closely with APS, Adult Protective Services, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. And the Long-Term Care Ombudsman deals with anyone that's living in a facility and local law enforcement. We conduct ongoing trainings and programs with first responders and community providers, and also with law enforcement. We have a first responders training that we do with them on a regular basis. We go out into the community and we meet with senior centers and other agencies to heighten the community's awareness of these crimes and what you might see in community groups. And possibly, we talk about what signs you may look for when you're dealing with a loved one or a friend, or, you know, Margie stopped coming out of her house. I feel like something's going on. Somebody's recently moved in, or, you know, her husband's acting kind of funny. And what we tell them, some of the warning signs are, we look, you know, the obvious ones, is there bruising? Do you see any scratches? Do you see any changed behavior? Maybe some passive, you know, behavior, confusion. She may be unkept. He or she may be unkept. You may notice, you know, certain odors that weren't there before. Maybe they're not allowed to shower. Or a victim or, you know, a friend may actually tell you, hey, I'm being abused. And that's a service that we like to get out there. And I personally and the people in my office like to tell people, if you are concerned that someone is being abused and you don't want to be the whistleblower, you're afraid that you're going to be found out, go ahead and call me. There's a form called a SOC 341, which is the referral to the Adult Protective Services program, and I'm more than happy to fill that form out. I can give them my work contact information, and nobody's going to be put in that situation, and that's something that I do on a regular basis, and it seems to work quite well for us. Just to have my contact information there in place. The next service that I would like to bring up is the Victims of Crime Program, and that's the one that Diana touched base on before. It's a program that our office helps facilitate with the state. It's a state-run program, and it's for victims of crime and their families, or their family members. There's $70,000 allocated for each victim of a crime. They can help. I always say we, but it's not actually our money. It's the state's money. But they can help with mental health counseling. They can help with dental benefits, medical benefits if someone has to go to the hospital or they've had a hospital stay. Relocation, there's up to $2,000 to assist in relocation. We can assist with residential security, which is a hard one. There's a cap of $1,000, which is not necessarily going to get you a whole security system into your house, but we can change your locks. We can add additional locks to your windows, doors. There's security doors that you can have put in place. We have several local locksmiths that we work with that they submit their bills to the state directly, and they're wonderful. It's a great service that they assist us with. We have lost wage if someone is not able to work due to becoming a victim of a crime. If they miss work, we have that. There's support for eligible family members. If you have someone that's deceased, and they have children, we can help with support for those children while they figure out, you know, what's going to happen next. There's also funeral and burial expenses. But how?
By
North County.
in that position.
Team to
but
You said not.
Abusing.
This does. or self.
Foster.
there any
checks. And then we do.
budget has fiscal year. With the up the
You do.
And aging.
when it takes.
Evening goes.
Different feelings.
that
reports.
That's all I have.
Stroke.
I recall.
Sometimes it's
2000.